This episode of Life and Books and Everything is brought to you by Crossway, publisher of the One Story Bible, tracing a thread of redemption through God's Word. I actually have a story about this. One of my kids said, "Dad, you write for Crossway. Can you get us a Bible?" I said, "I could probably do that. We can get Bibles." And I'm not sure why, my fifth grader looked online and he picked out this One Story Bible. And he's reading some of it, he's learning from it, and we got an early copy, so I'm excited to tell you about this. It has conversational commentary written by Greg Gilbert. Greg is a friend, I've written with Greg before, and this is a really good resource to help you see the storyline from start to finish. Whether you're an adult, need a refresher, you're learning for the first time, or as I just said, even kids can benefit from this. So pick up a copy of the One Story Bible wherever books are sold, or visit crossway.org/onestory. You get 30% off with a free Crossway Plus account. We also want to thank our friends at Desiring God for supporting the podcast. DG is relaunching their namesake book, Desiring God, by John Piper. Not many books that have come out in my lifetime deserve to be called classics, but I think this is one of them. Originally published nearly 40 years ago, Crossway is now releasing a new revised edition. I read this book soon after it came out. I've reread it since then. Desiring God is probably, if you're going to read one book by John Piper, read this one, where he unpacks those famous words, "God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him." So make your way through it. It's a heady book, but in the best way. It's also a heart-filling book. So pick up this new revised edition of Desiring God. Welcome back to Life and Books and Everything. I'm Kevin DeYoung, Senior Pastor at Christ Covenant Church, here just outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, and I am joined by the award-winning most, of all the awards he's won, I'm sure the one he's most proud of is being the most frequent guest on Life and Books and Everything. How can that compete with...
No question.
Oh, no question. Dr. Alan Gelzo, thank you so much for being back on LBE. I want to start with, you just made a massive move from Princeton to the University of Florida.
Correct.
Why would one do that? And what are you doing down there in the Sunshine State?
I have joined the faculty of the Hamilton School for Classical and Civic Education. An approach was made to me last year by the then director of Hamilton. And Hamilton is on a mission. And that mission is the promotion of classical and civic education. And it is the kind of thing that I look forward to doing. It's the kind of thing, in some respects, I have tried to do and wanted to do all through many years. And the people at Hamilton have made quite a case for that. They have recruited over 40 faculty for the Hamilton School. The expectation is that the Hamilton School will itself rise to or be promoted to a college within the university in very short order. So there is something very good that is happening this way at the University of Florida, and it seemed to me that I could come over and help them, as it were.
Do you know many of the other 40 faculty? I remember seeing some of the names, an august list. Are you, you know some of them?
I do know a number of them. I am learning still more. I know some of the older folks, but some of the younger folks I'm getting to know, and they are a treasure in their own right. I will say that one major attraction was the fact that the co-author of The Golden Thread is also making this move to Hamilton, James Hankins. So Hankins and I will find ourselves together on the same faculty, which is in a lot of ways fitting, since we go back quite a long distance. We went to high school together, and we were even in marching band together. He played the trombone, which is, I think playing the trombone, at least in those days, was a symbol of of moral decadence.
My brother played the
Only,
trombone,
you
yeah.
know, only, only, only the worst rapscallions in the band were in the
What
trombone
did you
section.
play?
In the concert band, I played the double bass,
All right.
and in the marching band, I was the drum major.
Well, quite an august group
Well, yeah,
then.
that was what created a problem with the trombone section, because in marching order, the trombones always are in the front rank of the parade. And they always had this running competition as to who could get their slide into the small of my back. So
And did James,
that probably
yeah,
contributes to the
contribute to
dim
it?
view I have of trombone players.
Yes, and understandably. I played the French horn, and then, yes.
Oh, there's a challenge.
I didn't say I played it well, but I did play
Well, I have been told that
it.
it's akin to trying to play two razor blades together,
Yes,
something like that.
yes.
Yeah,
It
okay.
is Paul Lim one of the professors at the New Hamilton
Paul
School?
Lim is one of the
Yes, I
professors,
knew
and Paul
Paul.
and I have had a wonderful time talking Reformed theology.
Yeah, he was at Gordon-Conwell when I was there, just overlapped a little bit. Of course, he's been at Vanderbilt and have a lot of mutual connections with him.
So we have talked Calvin, Owen, Edwards, Hodge, all the great ones.
Fantastic. Dr. Gelzo Allen has been on the program several times before, and we've talked about a number of his books. I think I've read all of these books here on this list. We haven't talked about all of them, but Abraham Lincoln, Redeemer President, Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, Fateful Lightning, History of the Civil War and Reconstruction, Robert E. Lee, Our Ancient Faith. So go check out all of those books and many more. Today we are talking about a book, as I said before we got on the air, that is a workout in itself just to lift it, let alone to write it. Anyone who's watching on YouTube can see the thickness of this. This is over 1,200 pages, co-authored by Alan Gelzo, and as he mentioned, James Hankins, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition, Volume 1, which I understand from reading the introduction, this is largely Professor Hankins' work, and Volume
That's
2 will be largely your work, but you did the introduction here, and I'm sure you collaborated on both. So tell me, how long? I mean, this is really impressive, and if you're listening on the podcast, you should go find this on Amazon, Google it, find some pictures of it, because not only is it well written and informative, it is really elegantly laid out. I mean, it is a textbook, but it's one you want to just keep thumbing through the pages, looking at the artwork, looking at the maps. This is an impressive project, and I'm only holding volume one. How did you conceive of this? How long has this been in the works?
There's a long answer to that, and let me compress it by saying that in the terms of the actual production of these two volumes, we're really talking about something which has gone on for about 5 years. But in the longest sense, Hankins and I have been writing this book for the last 50 years, because every time we've been together, these are the kinds of things we talk about. And whether we are discussing the importance of Bartok in 20th century composition, or whether it's Aristotle and Plato and the revival of Plato and the celebration of Plato's birthday in the Italian Renaissance, I mean, we've covered all these topics in one way or another over the years. So the short answer is 5 years. The long answer is several decades.
And I'm just imagining that this is probably culled from course lectures that you've given over the years. I mean, that this is a it isn't a project that one would try to attempt at, say, 35 years old. Where did the material come from?
Some of it was originally class material for both of us. Other parts of it were written fresh and new, but even then they emerge out of long acquaintance with these subjects. Just to give you some examples, some of the most recent chapters in Volume Two, which take us from well, that's well, the final chapter takes us from 1945 to 1991. All of that. That's written new. That was never class material. Other parts of it, We have had in some degree of circulation and talked about, rewritten, revised over many years. It combines all of those elements. We've drawn on all those resources over a lengthy period of time. Some of the very specific elements in Volume 2, for instance, are expansions of things I have talked about a little bit in class. I devote attention, for instance, to Blaise Pascal, and I expand on Pascal. Bach, especially. Bach gets a whole chapter
Oh, well
in
done.
Volume 2. And all of that is, in a sense, that is fresh material. It is not stuff that I have done in classrooms before or in other places before. So there's a broad mix of things in both of these volumes.
We're going to talk mostly about history, but I want to talk also about writing. You're a very good writer, and I can't claim to have read all 1,200 pages here of James's contribution, but I can see he's also a good writer. It is one thing to be very smart and to know history and know your way around sources. It is another thing to be able to communicate those ideas in accessible, elegant prose. Not looking for you to have to pat yourself on the back, but how did you learn how to write well, and have you found any good secrets to help students write well? I'm a seminary professor, and any RTS students, I love you out there. Writing, whew, I just don't even know how, by the time they get to graduate school, I think you're kind of past me teaching you how to write, and it seems like some people do, and a lot of people today just don't.
Kevin, if I had an algorithm for it, believe me, I would not be shy about sharing it. I have never been to a writing school. I have never been to a writing camp. I've never had instruction in writing. I wouldn't even know how to teach it. The closest thing I can compare what I do is to a story told about Tchaikovsky. Bernard Herrmann, a famous composer of film music, said that Tchaikovsky was once asked by a woman where he got his inspiration from. And his response was, "Madam, when I walk into my studio every morning at 8 a.m., the muses had better be on time." Quite literally, I don't. I suppose if the best thing I can do is describe some images. One is conversation. I'm trying to talk to you. I'm trying to talk to others. Another is organization. When I'm talking to others, I want to do it in as clear a sequence as possible so that people see how these things are connected. And I'm not just offering them impulsive pieces of information that don't relate to each other. And then a third thing is that I want to invite a response. There was a wonderful literary critic named John Gardner, for whom I have an outsized amount of respect. And I do not, and I will confess, I am not a great reader of literary criticism, but Gardner was a great literary critic. He said, "What do we want to do when we write? We want to prick people so that they bleed." He's borrowing himself a phrase from Shakespeare. But yes, that's what I want to do as well when I'm writing. I think alongside that, this is the second thing, and there'll be a third. But the second thing is I've had some wonderful examples. Even as a kid growing up, I was always a bookish kid. And I read some wonderful stuff, especially good history stuff. And within that category, I think of Bruce Catton, who was a wonderful writer, and his three volume.
Michigander.
Oh, well, yes. He, yeah, from and from way up in Michigan, too, wrote a wonderful memoir of his growing up in Michigan, Waiting for the Morning Train. But what he's best known for are his books about the Civil War. Even today, I pick down Catton from the shelf, and it's wonderful stuff. It's wonderful writing. He was a journalist to start but he was a journalist who researched well, and he knew how to communicate with people. And I, there is a sense of his prose being so evocative that there are moments when it reminds me of a Charles Ives symphony. So I had good examples to benefit from. And then a third very specific, very concrete moment for me was in 10th grade. I had an English teacher named Janet Hurt. She was a marvel. And among the things we were assigned to write about was Tennyson, The Idylls of the King. We all had to write this little three-pager
I doubt they do that in
on.
10th grade very often anymore.
Well, don't get me going on that. That will send Hankins on a tear because he also had Miss Hurt. We wrote this little three-pager. I wrote this little three-pager on Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And I turned that in. And it came back to me with red markup from the lay reader. This was an outside person who read these pieces and then made recommendations to our teacher, to Miss Hurt. And the piece was filled with these livid red comments. Do you not realize you have plagiarized? Do you not realize that plagiarism is a serious offense? Now, I knew I hadn't done anything of the sort. And I walked this up to Miss Hurt and I said to her, "Is this what you think?" She looked at me, she looked at the paper, and with a sort of a dismissive wave of the hand, she says, "I know who you are." That doesn't sound like a whole lot, but I want to tell you, at that moment, that was an affirmation that made all the difference in the
So
world.
this outside reader
Isn't
thought you must have been copying someone?
Yeah, yeah. But Miss Hurt knew otherwise. And that moment of affirmation was a real milestone for me, believe it or not. It really was. What it said was, I can do this writing thing. I can do it, and I will do it in a voice that people will recognize as authentic. And you might say that everything has flown downstream from that ever since.
It is wonderful. A lot of us have those moments, a specific teacher or a specific incident. I had a teacher, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. I do remember, I think he was a Hillsdale grad. So, good representation for Hillsdale. But he made us circle, or he would circle for us, every weak verb we used in an essay. Every, was, is, and especially if we backlogged one of those weak verbs, which is what I find students do a lot. They will put a long spiraling clause and then is something at the end. He said, you only can have five weak verbs on a page. You can't write without them. But he said, now I want you to go back and try to write this in a more active voice. And of course, I mean, a lot of that's lost on a 10th grader, but it was an exercise of nothing else to say, it takes a lot of work for most people to write well. And even those who get very good at it and can do it quickly, they had to work very hard at it sometime. Many people have said the adage, there's no good writing, there's only good rewriting. And most people require a lot of work to rewrite. When I tell students, I say, read your essay out loud to someone who loves you enough to tell you the truth. And when you read it out loud, it's amazing. I do this in my own writing. I think, wow, what? That didn't make sense at all. I also am often telling students, you need to do the work to connect the dots in the reader's brain. You can't pick a sort of ambiguous verb here in a connection that then anytime the reader has to stop and say, now I better think for 20 seconds what he means to say, you're not doing your job as a writer. And your prose is just elegant. I love to hear you read it too. You have a good, dulcet baritone. But it's also, you have opinions. And a writer who just has opinions without facts isn't very interesting. But someone who's telling a story, and Paul Johnson, the great historian, he was very opinionated when he would write. And even when you didn't agree with it, you just thought, well, I kind of like getting his take on it. And I get that with your writing. Now, this may be a little more close to the cuff when you're writing a Western Civ textbook, but I think once you learn how to master the material, you can put a little bit of personality into it.
Well, if I have to give a recommendation to anyone, one of the things that I would say first off is find a good model to imitate. Don't worry about the imitation at first. You'll find your own voice over time. Find a good model. Imitate that model. Write like that person. And as you develop that ability, your own voice will mature and will emerge from that. But don't be afraid of imitation. And in a sense, I mean, I've been imitating Bruce Catton all these years. But don't be afraid to imitate and use the imitation to build your own sense of how to speak in a plain, unadorned English sentence.
That's right. Well, let's talk about this book. Talking to Alan Gelzo, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. So I suppose one place to start is to say, why is a book like this necessary? Don't we have lots of books on Western civilization? What happened to the whole discipline that this book would require an essay at the front simply defending the study of Western civilization?
I think the need grows out of the fact that in large measure we are living in a time of civilizational crisis. And I think that crisis stems from at least two or three causes. One is a kind of studied indifference to Western civilization. We know now much better than earlier generations. We know how big the world is. We know how many different other civilizations there are and have been. And we feel that we have to accommodate all of it in order to do it justice. So there becomes a shrinking space on our mental shelves for Western civilization. Sometimes, though, I think this indifference to civilization is an ideological one. We're told that civilization is really just superstructure, that all real history is about the movement of economic forces and about the acquisition of power. That was Marx's contention. Superstructure, civilization, that's all false consciousness. But maybe the worst thing we have to deal with is a kind of open hostility, which blames Western civilization, which blames the Western tradition for a host of evils, for genocide, for colonialism, for imperialism, for slavery, for racism, as though these were not present in other places, but which were only manifest among those who were helpless victims of the West. So there is a hostility. And I won't say that even the hostility doesn't have at least some measure of justification, because look, the Western tradition, which is to say Europe and its worldwide appendages, the United States and Australia and New Zealand, and really almost all of the Americas. What have we been through in the last 100, 120 years? We've been through two world wars, which shouldn't have happened. We've been through episode after episode of shameless exploitation. And I think a large measure of the indifference and even the hostility is a response of guilt and pity for some of the things that the West has done, which have not been admirable at all. It's not difficult to come up with an indictment, except, of course, that other cultures do the very same things, other civilizations, other traditions. Do very similar, if not worse. But that has been the crisis, the making of the crisis for the West and people in the West. And in so doing, whether it stems from pity or whether it stems from contempt, what it has produced is a tremendous loss of the core elements of this thing that we call the Western tradition. And from that, we have a lot of skepticism, a lot of doubt, a lot of uncertainty. And that uncertainty gets replicated in the lives of people generally, especially the lives of students. So, in a sense, I would say that Hankins and I have written The Golden Thread as a way of reclaiming and renovating the idea of the Western tradition for a new generation of readers, in which we say, frankly, yes, there have been problems. There have been plenty of problems, but there have also been great things which have acted as the cure and the restraint on the problems, restraints which have not been present in other places and at other times. So this is the message we want to lay before people. We want to call people back to an understanding and appreciation of this thing called civilization.
And I want to talk about that because you have a great introductory essay here at the beginning, and one of the points you make is about the fragility of civilization. We can think of this world we inhabit. Yeah, it's kind of always been like this, and we get used to these things. And even the points you made, it's not to say, a Chinese civilization, Japanese civilization, Aboriginal civilizations, such that they may have civilization, don't have achievements, don't have beauty, accomplishments. But it's easy to look at the Western tradition and point to any number of isms. If you put an ism on the end of it, it's a huge bad: imperialism, colonialism, sexism. But the question is always, compared to what? To what are you comparing? And here, if we can talk like good Calvinists or Augustinians for a moment, if we understand that the default of human beings on this side of Eden is not to get along in perfect bliss and harmony, and they only need something to mess that up, but rather it is little Hobbes, life is poor, nasty, brutish, and short. That's how we tend to treat one another. And to have something ennobling and of beauty and of purpose and literature, these are goods that require, under God's grace, human ingenuity and human effort. I love to put together these two quotations. I can't give the exact one, but from Augustine, where one is about man's depravity, and then the other, you would think he was a 20th century romantic or something. He's so extolling what human beings can accomplish, all of which is to say that this civilizational inheritance really is an inheritance, and it's fragile. Talk to us about that fragility and why so many people miss that and assume, well, we always have all the good things, and we'll just keep those forever, and we'll just criticize the bad.
Because fragility occurs when a particular system of ideas becomes stale. Fragility occurs when a particular system of ideas of culture hardens and has no flexibility and therefore breaks easily. When the ideas are not strong enough to resist outside pressure. Not because there aren't the resources there for the resistance, but because people lose confidence that it's worth resisting. And when those problems occur, that is when a civilization moves into crisis. That's when a civilization moves into fragility. I think one of the chief problems in the promotion of fragility is overconfidence. We've always been doing well. We'll keep on doing well. We can't really hurt this terribly much. And the answer, of course, is, oh, yes, you can. You can do a great deal of damage simply by the decisions the human beings make. But there's another factor that enters in here as well, and that is, how do we remember? Are we passing things on? Is there a traditio, which, of course, is where the word tradition comes from? Do we make a conscious effort to pass this along? There's that line in Henry V where the king has finished saying, we'll be remembered, where our names will be familiar as household words. And he goes down the list of Warwick and Talbot and Bedford and so on. And he says, this story, in this case, the story of Agincourt, this story shall the good man teach his son. and Crisp and Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world, but we in it shall be remembered. The capacity that memory has to be filled with the contents of civilization, that's important. When we fail to do that for any of the above reasons I've mentioned, that's when civilization acquires the most deadly form of fragility. And we can lose that in a variety of ways. I mean, the Western tradition has been remarkable, and I want to say unique, for a number of key components. And one of them, right out in front, is the written word. The Western tradition is not an oral culture. It has reverence for language and for literature. And being able to write things down and pass them on, this gives a sense of stability, of scaffolding to this idea of a civilization, because we have to have that. And part of what we experience today as a crisis in civilization has been the evacuation of reading. Mm-hmm. There was an article I'd looked at just a few days ago, which talked about the great explosion of reading in the 18th century. That in the first decade of the 18th century in England, some 6,000 books were published. In the last decade of the 18th century, that number had become 56,000. People read, and they read voraciously. Now, how do people read? Now we hear the stories about assignments being given out in classes by students who can't make heads or tails of the first paragraph of Bleak House. Mm-hmm. When we lose that embrace of the written word, we have lost a tremendous aspect of this thing we call civilization. Go on from there. What do we do in Western civilization? We philosophize. We argue a lot. We specialize in the what's sometimes called the argument for the sake of heaven, that is above ordinary human decision making and is applicable to all. And then there's our pursuit and the accumulation of science. And this is also an attempt to understand how things work. Along with that, government and law and the impulse for freedom in speaking and in commerce and in freedom of association. And add to that the plastic arts and music. Because the arts are telling us that beauty is kin to truth. Mm-hmm. And therefore it is ennobling. And if we really want to get Calvinistic about this, I would send people to Edwards's treatise on true virtue. Because what makes true virtue something that we want to have in our own lives? Because, Edward said, because it is beautiful. It has genuine beauty. And that, in turn, leads us to the centrality of faith and monotheistic
because
faith.
For Edwards, that supreme delight starts with God.
Absolutely. I might add, too, that There's a remarkable aspect of the Western tradition and how urban it has been. And that's not an accident either in biblical terms, because, I mean, after all, the ultimate expression of glory is the descent of the New Jerusalem, mm-hmm. a city. And let me add one last thing to that. And one of the great strengths of the Western tradition that way has been what I'm calling resilience, which is a capacity for self-criticism. A self-criticism which took an institution like slavery, which has simply been accepted without question, without any twitch of disagreement for centuries and centuries out of mind. All of a sudden, one day we wake up and we decide, no, this is not right. Human beings should not own other human beings. That capacity for self-criticism is the last of this lengthy list of things that I think are remarkable attributes of the Western tradition, and which, when we don't mind them and tend to them, then they get choked off by weeds, the weeds of barbarism. And when those weeds have their toxic effect, what results is loss of self-control, destructive systems of ideas, illiteracy, and from illiteracy there stems indifference to the past, and ugliness. Ugliness in art, ugliness in music, ugliness in architecture, and
Brutalism,
along
yeah.
with it, an obsession with technology. It's very interesting that at the same moment that we have become hyper obsessed with technology, it's also the same moment in intellectual history when we have lost belief in science, so that we get Heisenberg and his uncertainty principle, and we get Thomas Kuhn and the structure of scientific revolutions. We lose our capacity to believe that science, in fact, is leading us to anything meaningful in the way of knowledge. So we are utterly camped out with technology, but we've lost our capacity and confidence in science. And that means that what we are developing is a kind of barbarism, which is based on the worship of power. And if that is the case, then yes, that means that civilization finds itself in crisis. We have gone fragile. How do we rebuild that fragility? How do we renew? Well, there are many ways to do it, but I would like to think that what Hankins and I are doing in Golden Thread is one step towards that renewal and towards that renovation.
I want to take a moment to thank Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary for their support of the podcast. You and your family are invited to the annual Confessional Conference hosted by Greenville Seminary. The theme for this year's conference is The Church, the Bride of Christ. The conference is March 10 through 12. Speakers include Ian Hamilton, Jonathan Master, Michael Morales, Mike Riccardi, Rhett Dodson, David Irving, and those are just some of the names. Whether you're new to Reform teaching, or you are learning more and more about it, or you simply are looking for a family conference full of good teaching and speakers, this may be a great fit for your spring schedule. There'll be rich teaching, singing, fellowship, considering what it means for the church to be the bride of Christ. There's also a children's program provided for kids ages 3 through 11. Registration rates will increase soon, so check it out and mark your calendars. March 10 through 12, go to gpts.edu. We also want to mention our friends at Reform Theological Seminary, the privilege of teaching at RTS Charlotte. If you are looking for a seminary close to home, one of the great things about RTS is it likely has a campus somewhere near you. Jackson, Mississippi, Orlando, Charlotte, DC, Atlanta, Houston, Dallas, New York City, and a fully online global campus. Degree programs in theology, biblical studies, counseling, prepare you for ministry, prepare you to be a pastor, prepare you to serve God more faithfully in whatever avenue He has given to you. World-class theological education rooted in God's inerrant word, and hopefully somewhere near where you live. There is no substitute for in-person seminary education whenever you can get it. So check out Reformed Theological Seminary. Learn more at rts.edu. You said at the very beginning the word remember. I'm reading this new book by David McCullough. How does he have a new book? Didn't he pass away? But they put together some essays and speeches, and he said, indifference to history isn't just ignorant, it is rude. Indifference to history is ingratitude.
Yes.
Which is absolutely true. And you think of how often, so I'm a pastor, the word remember, you have it both with the patriarchs and with the kings. They shall be buried in the tombs of their fathers. You think of that language which Tolkien deliberately echoes in The Lord of the Rings, and we shall have such a remembrance. And you reference the St. Crispin's Day speech. Go, YouTube, I know we're talking about reading, but if you haven't read it, go listening to this, go to YouTube, find the St. Crispin's Day speech. I think it's Kenneth Branagh who does the version there. It's stirring, and we're not even Englishmen, but it's stirring. But you,
We few, we happy
oh,
few,
yes.
band of brothers, for he this day who sheds his blood with me shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition.
And
That's the kind of thing I often say to my wife. It makes me so grateful we speak the same language as Shakespeare.
That is absolutely true. And it's that sense you want to be remembered. That doesn't have to be a selfish,
no,
unchristian, vain sort of exercise. And
what do you
remembrance is more than just you have it written down somewhere. It's a cultural, it's an intellectual, a moral, spiritual remembrance. And we're forgetful people.
What do you find in both Old Testament and New Testament? My father was a wandering Aramaean. All right? We're casting to the past. Look to the rock from whence you were hewn. Look to Abraham and Sarah. And you go through all of the patriarchs that way. And in the New Testament, we all passed through the Red Sea, says St. Paul. Yeah. We all passed through the cloud. Always the reference is this enormous sense of the past that we inhabit. And it's not just a past which occurred a long time ago and doesn't have any immediate connection to us. It is a past we carry around with us and inhabit every day.
And to be remembered is to mirror what God does with his people. So the covenant language is always, and he remembered Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Now, of course, God doesn't need help mentoring. He's omniscient. He doesn't forget things. But that's why it's so striking to use that word, remember. It's to signify God has not forgotten the past. You shouldn't either. He's not forgotten. If you want one, you know, as Christians, argument for history, God believes in history. He remembers his covenant. And we talk about what is the gospel. The gospel isn't just moral uplift and an inspiring hope that things get better. It is fact rooted in history. Something happened, and the supreme act of God himself coming down as a man, taking on a human nature and living and dying and being raised again in history shows us something. If you are to be human, let alone even certainly to be Christian, you have to be a remembering person, and we tend to be very forgetful. So in addition to this book, what practices, what can people do who are concerned? I hear lots of people talking about we need to, Western civilization's under assault. Maybe we need to fight to reclaim it. Okay, but
what do you do to
yeah
fight?
Sometimes the emphasis there seems to be on the fight,
right?
Okay, what are personal practices and habits that we can use to tie ourselves to this golden thread?
This is one of the great challenges, because what Hankins and I have done is only part, and maybe not even the most important part, of the answer of remembering, of recovering. Put away distractions. Concentrate on a handful of things. Dr. Johnson once said that a man can only be the master of one science, in other words, of one body of knowledge. Find that body of knowledge, become its master. Do that by putting away distractions. And Kevin, we live in an environment of incessant distraction from one screen after another. And I see this, I walked into a classroom some weeks before and I was substituting for someone else. I walked into the classroom, and the thing that struck me most in walking into it was how dead silent it was, because everybody in the classroom was looking at a screen.
Mm-hmm.
No one was talking to anyone else. So put away the distractions. Second, commit yourself to something which is beautiful. Find something which is beautiful. Understand why it is beautiful, not because lots of people buy tickets to it, not because lots of people say they like it. Explain to yourself why it is beautiful. Understand that it will take some work to figure out some things. It will take some work to understand why Bach is beautiful. But if you will listen and listen carefully, you will hear in something like the chorale prelude, Ich rufe zu dir, Herr Jesu Christ. You will hear in that, you will hear the cry of the heart. There, in a short piece, it lasts, what, 2.5 minutes? It's a short piece in which the throbbing bass pedal is like the man's heart. And the line itself is cry. I cry to thee, Lord Jesus Christ, in this minor key, and then it ends miraculously on the major. Listen for things like that. Listen for things like the chorale prelude that Bach wrote on the hymn tune In dir ist Freude, in thee is gladness. It's a very simple hymn tune. And he pitches into it right away, and you hear the first four notes. Dum, bum, bum, ba, ba. So he stops because from the pedals of the organ, there erupts this extraordinary state. Bum, bum, ba, da, 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 dum, bum. It's the expression of joy. In thee is gladness. And he never gives you the full statement of the hymn tune, of the chorale tune, because every time he gets to that, in thee is gladness,
There's more joy.
that second theme erupts. It's like I have to express joy. And you look at the craftsmanship of Bach. You look at how he structures the St. Matthew Passion so that the numbering of the pieces in it matches the 40 days temptation in the wilderness. And that's not an accident. He's deliberately crafting it that way. It's when you begin to see to the heart of things like that suddenly you realize, ah, here is a renovation that is taking place. Renovation begins with me perceiving it. But it takes work, it takes patience. We live in times that are not patient. We live in times that have things timed down to the minute.
And it
We have to make that space. I think of two literary illustrations which speak to what can be a promise and what can be a curse. One literary illustration is Ray Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451, where the principal character, Montague, the fireman, he's a fireman. You know what they burn? Books. Because Fahrenheit 451 is the temperature at which books ignite. Montague wants to get away from that. He runs. He finds in the forest, in the swamp, a group of people who have memorized the great books. And he joins them. It's a wonderful moment. We have to join them. We also have to be part of those great books because the other literary illustration is H.G. Wells's Time Machine, where the inventor of the time machine vaults forward in time to a place where it seems that everything technologically has been laid out and people are beautiful and they have no cares and they don't work and food is provided for them and they just go through the day and such. So it's a pleasant way. And he soon discovers that the reason for this is that underground, there are the Morlocks, and they are the evil geniuses. They make the machinery run, and they survive by cannibalism of these dainty creatures on the surface. Do we want to end up like the time machine? I would rather we pointed in the direction of Ray Bradbury than H.G. Wells. Now, I've cited two science fiction stories. That's not because I'm necessarily endorsing one genre at the expense of another, but I think those are two stories which offer us two ways in which we are likely to go. Which then do we want to pursue?
And part of what I hear you saying is one way to fight for Western civilization is to develop such a habit of mind and heart to be able to see what is true and good and beautiful and enjoy it. But not just to live in a museum, Well, someone wrote, recently they visited Italy and it was beautiful, but it seemed like there were people were not having children. It felt like this is where I would go to live in a museum, a lovely museum. So we want more than just to inhabit a museum, to continue as God gives us strength and breath to create and to enjoy and to develop. I wonder what you would say. I got a twofold question here. Massive question, but you'll give me something good here. One, to talk about Christianity's relationship to the Western tradition. And then two, this is a particular pastor question. Is there a danger that some Christian could be so enamored with this thing called Western civilization or Western tradition that they've swapped out one telos for another and have lost really the biblical plot line? It's a leading question, but talk about Christianity and its, in some ways, it is the Western tradition, or it's one of these elements, as how James explains it at the beginning. So talk about that. And then are there any dangers that Christians might listen to a podcast like this, get fired up, and turn their life into the recapturing of Western civilization and miss something more that Jesus was interested in?
They certainly can. They can miss, first of all, that Christianity itself is one of the core elements of this Western tradition. Now, Hankins and I speak in terms of a Western tradition rather than a Western civilization. And what we mean by that is the Western tradition is really built on successive layers of civilization. We start with the Greeks. We start with the Battle of Marathon. We move up from there to the Romans. We move up from there to the civilization of the Middle Ages. We move beyond that to the Reformation, to the Enlightenment. And these various layers of civilization all interact and rest upon each other. To miss the role that Christianity plays in that, to miss the role the Old Testament plays in that, simply on those terms, is to miss one of the great elements of self-criticism, the capacity for self-criticism. Because what else does Christianity ask us to do but to examine ourselves? Examine ourselves, see, in fact, if we are living lives worthy. And when we find we are not, to repent and to find a different way. That is one of the core elements. And if we can somehow reduce civilization to elements of art which are disconnected from that, that's going to make us not civilized. It's going to make us like Charlie the Tuna,
Yeah, decadent.
who had good taste when what people really wanted was something that tasted good. And what we want in Western civilization is some degree akin to that. We want something that will nurture, not merely allow us to admire ourselves in the mirror and say, oh, I've got more culture than so and so down the block. No, when you've done that, you have to take the advice of Luther, who said that when you imagine that you're a good theologian, reach back to your ears and feel them, and there you will find growing a nice long silky pair of donkey ears. And yes, that capacity for recognizing how this reflects to us and to the lives that we live. That's a gospel impulse. And that has to be there if we're going to be talking about a renovation and not merely a stroll through a museum.
Is there all that's very well said. Is there also a danger of you put it well, these layers build upon each other. And in some ways, among, let's just say, conservative sort of folks, sometimes there can be a tendency to want to repristinate the past, or if only we could have the martial zeal of the Crusaders, or if only we could be Charlemagne on Christmas Day again, and never mind how the Saxons felt about Charlemagne. Or if only it could be Geneva under John Calvin, although I know, Catholics and others would say, no, surely let's not pick that. If only we could be among the founding fathers. So how do you, because you have heroes from the past and you have ages that you love. How do you enjoy that? Rightly have heroes. We're meant to have heroes. We're meant to find something even nostalgic in a place we haven't visited, namely the past, without falling into this trap of thinking that was the golden age, that was the answer, and that now is the answer for today, when very rarely, if ever, is the answer for today, except if we're dealing with unchanging, gospel truth, is the answer to say, go back 300 years and let's play that back again.
No, it doesn't work, and it doesn't work specifically because of a biblical injunction. And that is the exhortation that Mordecai gives to Esther. How do you know that you have not been sent to the kingdom for such a time as this? You are living now. You're never going to be able to replicate all the dimensions of the past. The dimensions of the past are very, very complicated. You don't know enough. None of us knows
Right.
enough to rebuild something, to go back and experience it. No, that even if you went back yourself physically in time, you would be lost. You wouldn't have the faintest idea. You would be wondering, first of all, where's the bathroom?
Where's the air
And they would all
conditioning?
look at you and say, what's a
Yeah,
bathroom?
that's right.
That is a very simplistic, very Jejune way of going at this. No, you take inspiration from lessons. You take inspiration from character. You are grateful for events and for people, but you're not under any illusion that you have been put in any other place than the one you are in now, unless you'd like to suggest that God makes mistakes and he sent you to the wrong address. No, I don't really think that's the case. You draw on all these other elements of the past to give you strength to deal with the present. And dealing in the present, you haven't got guarantees. You do not know that every decision you make is going to be the right one. You don't know that every decision someone else makes is going to be the right one. You would hope you will have learned a few things by your study of the past and of culture, but you're not under any illusions that the situation that you are looking at is a fresh and new one. And that is why you have to pray for guidance. If all you had to do was renovate the past, who would need to pray? You would already have the blueprint. No, but you don't, not really. And that is why there's a sense of humility and dependence that is taught you by a serious study of the past, not a superficial one, but a serious study of the past, a serious embrace of civilization. You know how easily it can be lost. You know how easily you can make mistakes about it. You know not to trust entirely to your own strength. And when you bear that in mind, yes, then you are able to talk about a genuine renovation, a renovation for our own times. The Renaissance was not a recreation of Golden Age Athens. It was not a renovation of Republican Rome. The American Republic itself was not a renovation of Republican Rome, as much as we sometimes like to wear the cultural symbols of it. But it wasn't. It wasn't. And today we are not going to replicate the past. We are going to be taught and encouraged and guided by it. But we have a work of our own to do. And precisely because we do not know how it is going to turn out, that is going to teach us dependence. It's going to teach us humility, or at least it should.
We, at least here in America, will celebrate next year 250th anniversary. I'm sure you're having a part to play with some commissions and agencies and videos and such. And I'm looking forward to it because I love, I studied Witherspoon and I love the Continental Congress and I love the Declaration. So I'm looking forward to all of it. And at the same time, to your point, we're 250 years later. We have 340 million people in the United States. Same God, same gospel, same Bible, different world. Now, the good thing is We understand there are some principles, some things about human nature that don't change. Look, nothing about God changes. There are some insights that we can build on with this civilizational tradition. And yet, we can't go back to Boston 1773 or Philadelphia 1776. And as you said, we would be missing indoor plumbing very much and air conditioning, and we would die of yellow fever and a lot of other bad things.
And the average lifespan would be 46 years.
Yes, that's right. So we're both gone. Even me, my young age. One of the things I think as Christians to keep in mind, this is just true for everyone, but as a Christian, believe God is ultimately sovereign. And the Heidelberg Catechism says that providence is God's almighty and ever-present power by which he upholds, as with his hand, heaven and earth, and so rules all creatures, that leaf and blade and rain and drought and fruitful years and lean years, all of it. Prosperity and adversity come from his hand. We believe that. At the same time, as we live our lives with that confidence that God has written this story, we live our lives with contingency. Not ultimately, as a libertarian free will might understand it. But it's easy if we look back at history to think, well, of course that's the way it went. But there's no of course about it unless you're God, because all of those events, it didn't have to go that way. And
No,
that
not.
means where we are right now, which is a very hope-filled and scary proposition, it means that our actions really do have the possibility to make a better or a worse future. And I think it's easy. One of my professors in history, and I learned a lot from him, but he really did like the cyclical view of history. And there are just certain things, each nation was a hegemon for 100 years, and you could sort of count on that. And it gave a certain predictability to it. And I think we like to think of history as just such big, massive, impersonal forces. The next 25 years are sort of all, they're kind of faded out. It's just going to be what it is. But that's not what we should learn from history. Give that here as a final word. I'm talking to Dr. Alan Gelzo, this wonderful book, The Golden Thread. Just talk to us about the scary part, but more so the hope in the fact that our real choices and activity, we're in the history right now, even
Yeah.
though we can't see it and we don't know it.
The scary part is that even within the Western tradition, there have been moments when we almost lost it completely.
World War
One of those
II?
moments.
What else would you say?
Well, what I mean by that is take the fall of Rome, for instance. There, we lost huge components of the written records and writings of people from the ancient world, and some of them have never come back, and we'll never get them back. They were destroyed in various ways. But we survived by the skin of our teeth, as Kenneth Clark said at the very opening of his great series on civilization. We did survive by the skin of our teeth in a few places. There's monasteries out on the fringe of the British Isles, other places hither and yon. And we came back. So the scary part is, yeah, we almost lost this, but we came back. We almost lost it again, I think, after the Great Plague in the middle of the 1300s. Once again, absolute demographic devastation. And yet, after that came the Renaissance, an era of renewal. It was after the plague that Petrarch makes his ascent of Mount Ventoux. And in many ways, this is really the moment from which we can date this thing called the Renaissance. Even the 30 Years' War. 30 Years' War was devastating. We think World War I, World War II were devastations. They sure were, but 30 Years' War was as well. We could have lost it then, too. But we did not. We came back from that. There is a resilience in the Western tradition, but it's a resilience that has to emerge from the kinds of decisions you were describing. Conscious decisions that, yes, this thing is worth. It is worth surviving. It is worth preserving. It is worth inhabiting. I mean, when I talk about survival, it sounds like I'm doing an archaeological reconstruction. No, it's not a matter simply of of repristinating something long gone. It is a matter of inhabiting it, because the Western tradition is a tradition for living. And it begins with all those components that I talked about before. It can be lost. That's the scary part. But the really heartening aspect of it is how frequently it has shown the capacity for renewal. We can be part of renewal again. Now is the time. Now is the hour.
Well said. I will give that the final word. But talking to Dr. Alan Gelso, who has been on many times, we'll send his gold jacket soon for the Five Timers Club. He's written this wonderful new book with James Hankins, colleague, longtime friend of Alan's. It's called The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition, Volume 1, The Ancient World in Christendom, is now out. It's a big, heavy book. It is worth getting. Just read parts as you can. Some people will have it as a textbook. They will be fortunate if they do. Alan, when can we look forward to Volume 2, which is mainly your work, to be released?
We are hoping, in the publication and production process, we are hoping perhaps end of October, certainly before the turn of the year.
Great, good. So
it's coming.
Good, very soon. So these will adorn my shelves. And thank you so much for being on LBE once again. To all of our listeners, this has been a Ministry of Clearly Reformed. You can check out our website and get thousands of resources and articles, videos, podcasts, things like this. So until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.